From Entrepreneur Media, this is Problem Solvers, a show in which entrepreneurs do what entrepreneurs do best, solve unexpected problems in their business.
We were completely wrong.
And I'm just like, it's not selling.
It was like, we have to start from scratch.
I'm Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. Many years ago, Jeff Wetzler worked for Teach for America, and one of his jobs was to oversee a network of summer institutes. So, you know, what do you do if you oversee a network of summer institutes? Well, you spend the whole year making sure that come summer, these things are ready to open and be successful. And at the very last minute, just before opening, Jeff discovers something. One of his team members tells him that one of the institutes is not ready to open at all. Just completely unready for action. Nothing has been set up. People are not aligned. Jeff cannot figure out what went wrong. Why is he just learning about this now? I mean, he's been talking to his team about this for months. Nobody ever said anything about the problem. What's the problem? Now, I think that this is something that in one way or another, we can all relate to. It's like, why did I not know about this before? Why am I interacting with this person and not learning the important information that I should? Why am I managing anything, but I don't have all the information? And I'm going to quote from a book that Jeff just wrote about this exact situation. He writes this. He wrote, "Bottom line, I was unaware of what multiple people on the team knew about how bad things were, but never told me. And while I am sure that I had asked a number of questions during our meetings, the approach I'd taken clearly hadn't encouraged my colleagues to feel safe, giving me real talk about the challenging but absolutely critical information I needed to know before the point of crisis." End quote. All right. Now, what you heard there is possibly a little different than what the average person might think in this situation. Here is Jeff. He is managing, he is discovering something terrible that he did not know about. And I think a lot of people's instinct might be to say, oh my God, what is wrong with the people who I manage? What is wrong with them? Why do they not tell me? This is their fault. But that's not what Jeff said, right? That's not what Jeff said. Jeff said, "While I'm sure I had asked a number of questions during our meetings, the approach I'd taken clearly hadn't encouraged my colleagues to feel safe, giving me real talk about the challenging but absolutely critical information I needed to know." All right, what is he saying here? He's saying that it's his fault. He's saying that as a manager, he didn't ask the right questions, that he was the person responsible for getting the information, not the team that happened to have the information. He was responsible for getting the information, and he didn't because he wasn't asking the right questions. This sent Jeff down a path to understand this subject, to understand what are the better questions to ask? How do you make sure that when you are in a position to learn, to manage, to know, that you are asking people what matters? Jeff wrote a wonderful guide to this exact thing, to how to get the information that you need out of people, how to understand what they really think. The book is called Ask. Tap into the hidden wisdom of people around you for unexpected breakthroughs in leadership and life. And today I'm going to talk to Jeff about what it is that we're missing when we're asking the questions we think get us the answers.
There's one kind of classic study of organizations that talks about how upwards of 80-85% of people in organizations are not sharing important things with others around them, especially with their managers, and that they're basically saying three quarters of their colleagues also know about this stuff and are not sharing it as well. So if you just think about the amount of collective intelligence in organizations that is basically being shut down, that is basically being dormant, it is staggering.
That, as you might have guessed, is Jeff. Just a quick thing about Jeff. Who is Jeff? Jeff used to be the chief learning officer at Teach for America. He is now the co-CEO of Transcend, a nationally recognized education innovation organization. He earned a doctorate in adult learning and leadership from Columbia University, bachelor's in psychology from Brown University. He's a member of the Aspen Global Leadership Network and more. So in other words, this is a guy who understands how people learn, how people share information, and how we can do better by simply improving the way we ask. That's what's coming up today on Problem Solvers, right after this break. We all want the best of both. Dessert without calories, luxury without expense. And how about security without passwords? With Okta, it's possible. Okta secures identity for your business so you can safely use any technology. You can build experiences that are richer and more secure, grow revenue without running up costs, and scale easily no matter your tech stack. Enjoying the best of both? It's possible. It's Okta. Okta, the world's identity company. To learn more, visit okta.com. All right, we're back. Today, I am talking with Jeff Wetzler, author of a book called Ask, and it's about exactly that, how to ask the right questions that lead you to the right insights, how to understand what is in people's heads by getting better at just asking them. And quick note, this conversation took place live, virtually live, in a online community that I host. It is called One Thing Better, which is also my newsletter. If you are interested in learning more about that, you can just go to onethingbetter.email. That's a web address. Just plug it into a browser, onethingbetter.email. Anyway, I'm telling you that mostly because you might notice that we're pretty casual in this conversation. And occasionally I mention something that someone who's watching says, bring in a question from a viewer, so to speak. So anyway, let's jump into it. The starting point for this conversation was that Jeff started to explain why things are getting lost. Like, why are people not comfortable sharing the information that they need to share with the person that, frankly, they're supposed to be sharing it with?
It does get exacerbated across lines of difference. There are particular patterns that fall along lines of power, race, gender, other identity markers. But it's not limited to organizations as well. There was another study that I came across for the book that talked about the relationships between patients and doctors, and how somewhere between 60 and 80% of Americans, depending on background, don't share important things about their own health with their doctors. And so think about it. If we're not even telling our doctors things that could be matters of life and death, that could help us be healthier to live well, and the doctors are not finding out this information, imagine all the other things that we're not telling one another. And so the first section of the book really deals with this question of what are people not telling us? And I saw a pattern of four big things that often the people around us, too often the people around us are not telling us. The first is their struggles and their challenges. And so just the same way that the people on my team were not telling me what they were really struggling with, it's quite often that we're not really finding out what someone is up against. They're in some way or another suffering in silence and making it very difficult for us to help them because we're not finding out what they're going. So that's number one. A second thing is what they really think about an issue, especially if their view is unpopular, especially if it's a controversial issue, especially if you have any power, if there's any power dynamic at play. And if we are finding out a glimpse of their view, we're probably not finding out where it really comes from. What are the reasons? What are the underlying life experiences that they have? So that's number two. A third one is their best feedback for us, their observations of what we could be doing better, how we're impacting them and other people, why we're having this unintended impact on our team's morale or our partner or whatever it may be. And then the fourth one is their biggest, craziest, wildest ideas that might actually be the idea that we need to hear, the thing that could pivot our team, the thing that could actually be the breakthrough, but that they're sitting on it, maybe because they think it's too crazy, who knows why. But those are the top four things that I have discovered people around us are not telling us. And I look at those as almost like untapped gold mines right under our noses, that if we could actually find out that those things, we would undoubtedly make better decisions. We would save a lot of time. We would innovate together better. We would certainly have closer relationships. So I have not yet gotten to your question of why, but I want to just start with what. Do you want to jump in or should I keep going?
No, that's great. Look, I'll just make an observation, which is that those four things all in some way or another feel like the riskiest to share. I think about those things for me and I think, do I want to tell my colleagues or a boss or something that? Because now they have information that I don't know how they're going to react to it. I don't know what they're going to do with it. It feels scary to share that. It's useful to see that list and to think of it from the perspective of what maybe don't I share? Because when we are the person who wants to be shared to, we think to ourselves, but wait a second, I have great relationships with people. I'm not a scary person. I'm not coming off as judgmental. So like, why wouldn't they want to tell me things? But then as soon as you flip it and you think, well, do you volunteer this stuff? Do you volunteer what you really believe and feel about an issue? Do you really volunteer your honest feedback just out of nowhere? You realize, oh, no, wait, I don't. It's just, it's not the most natural thing to be telling people.
Totally. The number of times I've thought to myself, it's just me. Why? I'm not scary. I'm a schmuck who's barely holding it together. And yet that's not how other people are experiencing me. So to go into this question of why aren't they telling, because I think it is illuminating and it's important for us to have empathy as to why people may not be telling us things. The top reason by far, I think you alluded to, is just fear of the impact. What if I say it? Are they going to get pissed off? Are they going to crumble? Are they going to punish me? Is it going to put tension in our relationship? All of those are basically fear of the impact of what I have to say. So that's number one. A second one is sometimes people just don't have the words to say it. Like they might have a gut feeling, or maybe they do have words, but they know if they say those words, it's going to make it worse. And you know, sometimes it's also just about not having words because the mind races too fast. In the research for the book, I discovered that the human mind can think at something like 900 words a minute. That's how fast thoughts can be racing through our minds. But the human mouth can only get out about 125 words a minute, maybe 150 if you're from New York, but that's about as fast as it goes. And so at any given point, we're basically hearing about 15% of what someone's thinking, not because they're maliciously holding it back, not even because they're afraid. The mask just doesn't work, which is fascinating to me. Another reason people don't tell us is that they are just busy. It takes time. It takes emotional cost. And in a world where people are just are already fatigued, it's faster to not say it, because then if they say it, maybe you want to have a conversation about it. And so people are just trying to be efficient. But to me, the most interesting reason and the most actionable reason why people don't tell us is they don't realize we want to know. They don't actually think we're interested. They don't realize that we would actually value hearing all those things that you put in the list, Jason, in the chat. And that's an easy one to do something about, because we can signal it. But none of this would be a problem if we could actually read people's minds. If we could accurately guess what the people around us were thinking and feeling and knowing, I wouldn't have needed to write the book. But what's interesting is that research shows that we are really bad at this. We are barely better than chance in terms of guessing what people think. And it's no better. In fact, it's a little bit worse with people that we're close to in relationships like significant others, because we think we know them, but we actually don't know them as well. And most of the conventional wisdom for what to do about this doesn't work. So wisdom, try to put yourself in their shoes. Like research shows that doesn't work. Try to read their body language. Research shows that doesn't work. Even trained TSA agents get it right less than 1% of the time to really know what someone's thinking and feeling. There's literally only one thing that research has demonstrated over and over again reliably allows us to know what the people around us are thinking and feeling, which is to ask them. But we don't do it enough, and it's harder said than done. And so that's really what the core of the book is about.
So let's dig into it. What are we doing wrong? First of all, I was about to ask you, Jeff, what are we doing wrong in asking them? But actually, probably what we're doing wrong is that we're not asking them.
That's
is that
the
right?
First thing. That's the first thing. We can get into the fine points of how to ask, but most of the time we're not asking. And so we can get into that now if you want to.
Yeah, let's. What does it even mean to ask? Here's the thing. Let's go back, because this is just a really nice practical example. You were a Teach for America. There was something terribly wrong with this thing that you were overseeing. Nobody told you until probably they just couldn't wait any longer, and they had to tell you. But you should have known months earlier, and they weren't going to share for whatever reason. And it's easy to say you should have just asked, but ask what? Ask, hey guys, is anything terrible happening that I'm not aware of right now? What was it that you were supposed to be doing in that moment or in that series of months that asking would have solved, and how to even start approaching that?
Yes. And I'll use this as by way of introducing the core method of the book called the ASK approach, which are five steps or five practices for really tapping into what those around us really think, feel, and know. And so the first thing I think I was doing wrong in that situation is I was not curious enough. I just took what they said on face value. I was not actually curious about what else might I not be seeing here. What else might they be up against? How might I be impacting them in ways that are making it harder for them to say that? And so I was fairly certain that what they were telling me was the full story. And I was not nearly curious enough about what more could I be learning about what's going on here. And so step one of the ask approach I call choose curiosity. And that's really about lighting the fire of curiosity, of really a desire to learn and understand from other people in our own minds. And I talk about it as a choice because I don't believe that curiosity is just a trait that some people have and other people don't have. I don't believe it's just a state of mind that we're in, like I'm feeling curious today, but not curious. I really believe it's a decision. And it's a decision that's always available to us. And that when we make that decision to choose curiosity, we're really centering a question in our minds, which is, what more can I learn from this person? What else is there to know? And when we put that question at the center of our minds, it tends to push out other questions. Questions like, how can I show them I'm smart? How can I show them they're wrong? How can I get out of here? Whatever it is, how can I get them to do something? So it's really about centering that question in our minds. And when we center that question in our minds, it really opens up all kinds of other questions. Like, what do they see that I don't see? And what's a different way to understand what's going on here? And what else, how might I be impacting them? All kinds of questions start to come alive when we choose curiosity. So that was, to me, is the first thing. I was not curious enough in that situation. But the second thing was, even if I was curious, and I think I was a little bit curious, even if I wasn't enough, they didn't feel safe to tell me their truth, especially a hard truth. And so this is all about increasing the psychological safety at the interpersonal level in our interactions. And this is especially important if there's any line of difference or any line of power that we're crossing. And it's really about making it safer, easier, more comfortable, more appealing to be for other people to tell us what they truly think and feel and know, especially if it's something hard. And there's a few strategies that are important in this. Some of it is around building connection and creating a base of trust before you need to be asking the question. But some of it is even just about the time and space and place of the connection. For the book, I interviewed a bunch of CEOs, iconic CEOs of organizations like Kraft and Medtronic. And I chose CEOs because CEOs are notorious for not getting the truth from people. They are notoriously insulated from the truth. People tell CEOs what they think the CEO wants to hear or what will make them look good. And so I said to these CEOs, how did you possibly get people in your organizations, especially people a couple of layers away from you, to tell you the truth? And one of the biggest themes that came out was literally the time and space and place of the interaction. They said, I'm never going to have someone come into my office, sit across the big CEO desk from me, and assume they're going to feel comfortable telling me what they really think and feel. No, I'm going to go to them. I'm going to go wherever I think they're most comfortable. Maybe that means I'm going on a sales call with them. Maybe that means that I'm having lunch with them. Maybe we're taking a walk. And there was no single right answer other than whatever is going to make that other person feel most safe and comfortable. That's when it's going to come out. And so I think that's a relatively easy and straightforward tactical thing that we can be thinking about to make it safe, which is, where are they going to feel safe? I also find that true in my personal life as well. So I have a teenage daughter. When she comes home from school or at dinner and I say to her, how's your day? What did you learn? What happened? I get very little back from her. I mostly get, leave me alone. I want to do my homework, whatever. But if I stay up until 11 o'clock at night and she's done with her homework, she's done talking to her friends, I'm in her room, she doesn't want me to leave. She just wants to tell me all kinds of things that happen. And that's for her where she feels comfortable and safe. And so that's a big part of it. Another part of it is opening up. If we want other people to feel safe opening up to us, we need to open up first. We need to open up about why we're asking these questions, what our agenda is, what we don't know, what we're struggling with. And that models the kind of vulnerability that we're inviting in reciprocity from them. And then another piece of it is what I call radiating resilience, which is basically to let them know we can handle their truth, that we can actually, we're not going to crumble when they tell us that. And so that can sound as simple as, look, if I were in your shoes, I might be incredibly frustrated right now. And if that's what you're feeling, I would totally understand. I'd love to hear more about that. And by saying that out loud or putting that on the table, I had an investor who radiated resilience by basically saying to me, I really want to know how our investment is playing out. And by the way, I'm assuming it's not playing out the way you pitched it to me in the first place. And if it was, you'd be making a lot of money picking stocks and horses and all those kinds of things. And so if you tell me things are going smoothly, and I'm going to be very suspicious. Now, how's it going? And so she basically radiated that resilience and let me know that, like, she could, not only could she handle hard things, she demanded hard things as well. So all of that goes under the bucket of make it safe. That's number two. Do you want me to pause or should I keep going?
No, first I will acknowledge Julie and Kara sharing your struggles with parenting a teenager. I have a now 9-year-old and a 5-year-old. The 5-year-old just made an appearance. He says everything, regardless of if we are interested or not. The 9-year-old at this point is also not really telling us much when he comes home from the day. So I can't even imagine what it's like as a teenager. So I totally get it. Yeah, I think that's really valuable what you're sharing about how to be seeing these interactions from someone else's point of view. That's ultimately what this is really. This is about interacting with people, but making sure that the way that you're interacting with them is taking into account an inherent discomfort that they're going to have sharing the kinds of things that we most want them to share. And therefore, what we need to do is not on our own account, but it has to be on their account to be able to open them up.
Yeah, great summary. And there's a lot of research that shows that it's impossible to really put ourselves in other people's shoes. It's really impossible to take perspective of theirs because we don't have their perspective, but we can seek their perspective. And I talk about perspective seeking versus perspective taking, which I think is a good segue to number three, which is the questions that we ask to actually seek that perspective. And so step three of the ask approach is called pose quality questions. And my definition of a quality question is very simply a question that helps us learn something important from someone else. And I distinguish quality questions from what I call crummy questions, because so much of what passes for questions, I think, are not quality questions. There's all kinds of crummy questions. Some crummy questions are very innocent, and I just call them clumsy. Like when someone is saying what they think, and then at the end, they just say, isn't that right? Or don't you, wouldn't you agree? And I think that they actually might be sometimes wanting to know, do you actually agree? But the way that you pose that, when you just say, isn't that right at the end, makes it very difficult for the other person to really know, do you want to know if they disagree or not? Or do they have to be like an idiot not to agree? But there's also crummy questions that are what I call sneaky questions. Questions that are trying to maneuver someone to an answer based on asking them questions. We see lawyers do this all the time when they're trying to lead the witness in some way. But it could also be, wouldn't it be better if we went here for dinner instead of there for dinner? Or why would you think that? So all kinds of, often questions get used to manipulate people. And the other person can feel that. There's also attack questions. And so there's a whole bunch of questions that I put in the bucket of crummy questions. But quality questions, I think of in the same way that I imagine a surgeon might think about their scalpel and all their other tools. So the definition of quality questions is very simple. Questions that help us learn something important from someone else. And in this part of the book, I lay out a taxonomy, because I think most of us have a very narrow repertoire of good quality questions that we ask. We might have our favorite go-to question, help me understand this or that, which is fine, but it's too narrow of a repertoire. We can actually have a much broader set of questions. And I'll just give you one example of, I think, a very underutilized question strategy, which is what I call requesting reactions. And this simply means that we state our point of view, and then instead of stopping and waiting for the other person to react or not react, we just add the question, what's your reaction to that? How does that land with you? How does that sit with you? What does that make you think? What might I be missing? Any number of those questions are the kinds of questions that actually let the other person know we want their reactions, that we value, we need their reactions. And I think too often we assume, oh, if they disagree, they're going to tell me their reaction. Or if they don't want to do this, they're going to tell me their reaction. But they don't, for all the reasons why we just talked about, people don't feel safe often telling us those things. But if we pose that question in such an open way, what's your reaction to that? We're far more likely to elicit. I remember in one of my, I feel like this is almost like my therapy and confessional of bad management moments. But in one of my other management moments, I was just learning this strategy. And I had just given feedback and direction to someone that I was managing as a new manager. And then I said to myself, let me just try out this thing I got trained on. And I said to him, so what's your reaction to what I just said? And he looked at me for a minute. He was quiet. And then he said, honestly, if you really want my reaction, I find that completely demotivating. And I was shocked. And had I not asked that, he never would have told me. So then we could unpack it. And what it turned out is that he and I had different information about what our client needed. And so he thought what I was asking him to do made no sense. Once we were able to exchange the assumptions and the information that we had, we were able to get back on the same page. And he was motivated and he did a great job. But had I not asked that question, we might have wasted days or weeks and our relationship would have frayed. And so it took almost no time to pose that question, but it very quickly course corrected us. So that's just one of a dozen different quality question strategies that I think we all need to know and master to help us learn different kinds of things. I see a couple of things in the chat. Yeah, and I appreciate the candidness from him as well.
Yeah, the candidness was really great. And what else do you think that you did, if anything, to prompt that candidness? Because you could have said, what's your reaction to that? And he could have said, this guy Jeff's an idiot and he's telling me something that doesn't make sense. And so I'm checking out here. I'm just going to say my reaction to that is sure, even though I think that it's a terrible idea.
I think we did have a prior relationship. So some of the things that under make it safe, like create connection with the other person. I think we were in a space where there was time and it was conducive to be having that kind of conversation. I give him credit for his candidness as well. So I think all of that combined, and there's no guarantee that he would have said that to me or that anyone would say that to me, but I'm almost fully certain that had I not asked the question, I would not have gotten that from him.
Yeah. Something I've noticed, there's a guy I do some work with on a project, and he's really good during group meetings of asking that question of anyone who just hasn't talked in a while. So if we're talking about something and I haven't said anything in a few minutes, then he'll just turn to me and be like, Jason, what's your reaction to that? Or like, how do you feel about that? And I really like it because it not only prompts good dialogue, but it also just ensures that everyone is engaged and that conversations aren't just taken over by the loudest voices or the ones who maybe think that they have the most to add to something. I mean, that's often the reason why I'm not speaking in some certain situation is I just think, I have less to add than Lisa does. So I'll just let her speak. And maybe I have something to say, or maybe if you force me to say something, I will start talking and maybe get to an interesting point. And I would have never done that unless I was asked.
Perfect example. Yeah. And sometimes you may not, to your point, you may not have even worked out your own thinking until you have a chance to just verbalize it out loud a little bit as well. Yeah. I love that. So should we go to number four?
Yeah, let's go to number four.
Number four is basically what happens after you ask the question, which is how well do you listen? And so number four is called listen to learn. And I talk about how it's important to listen for more than just the content of what someone's saying. And so I personally gravitate towards the content, the information, the numbers, the facts, the figures, the claims, the logic, all those kinds of things. But I've discovered over time, that's only one third of what's going on in a conversation. There's not just the content, but there's also the emotion. What is someone feeling upset? Are they feeling frustrated, resentful, excited, motivated? And people can both express their emotions and display their emotions. And so we've got to be listening for that. And then the third is also listening for the action that someone is taking. So are they repeating themselves? Are they clarifying things? Are they offering support? Are they pushing back? Those are all things that we can be listening for as well. And so content, emotion, actions, I talk about as three channels to be listening through. The same way that I think a music aficionado or musician would be able to listen for the harmony and the vocals and the percussion and be able to isolate each one, but then when able to put it back together, to be able to just have so much a richer sense of the piece of what's going on. And so that's a big piece of listening to learn. And then there's a lot of different strategies for how to do that. One of my favorite strategies is just what I call pull the thread, which is a recognition that usually the first thing that someone has to say to us may not be the most important thing to be learning from them, or it may not be their most important answer to the question. I also interviewed a number of professional listeners for this book as well. One category of those was psychotherapists. And psychotherapists have this thing that they call the doorknob moment, which is that if it's a 50-minute session, like at minute 49 or minute 50, as their patient is about to walk out of the room, has the hand on the doorknob to leave, that's when they drop the biggest and most important thing. I'm about to leave my spouse, or I'm getting investigated, or any number of different kinds of things. And it's like, why didn't they say that in the first 49 minutes of the session when we could have actually talked about it? And there's all kinds of interesting theories, including the fact that maybe they were working up the courage, or maybe they didn't know if it was going to be safe, or maybe they didn't have the words to do it. But it's a known phenomenon, this doorknob moment thing. And I think that the same can be true in conversations with us. If we just ask a question to someone and then that we get the answer and then we say, okay, great, I got it. And then we move on. I think this is actually part of what's wrong with me and my Teach for America situation as well. I got an answer. I thought, okay, that must be it. But that's often not the most important thing. And so simply just saying, what else? What more? Can you say more about that? And sometimes even with my own team, I'll say, to them, I'm just going to keep asking you what else until you tell me that's it. Because every time I ask you that question, you give me something even better. And so I'll respect it when you tell me that's it. But I'm just so you know, that's why I'm going to keep asking you that question. And so that I just call that pulling the thread. And there's so much richness that I think we can get from that. And then go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I just want to say that the pulling thread reminds me, and psychotherapists remind me of this line that I got from a friend of mine who's a psychotherapist, which is just say more about that.
Yeah, exactly.
It uses that a lot in therapy sessions. And I found that when I use it in conversation with people, it is incredible. When somebody says something interesting, but you know that there's more behind it, see, Beth, then saying, say more about that instantly opens them up. This is like the magic language. And I thought a lot about why that is. And I think the answer, you tell me, the answer is that it's the same reason why people talk to a reporter. Why does anybody talk to a reporter? It doesn't make any sense. Why would you talk to a reporter who's going to take all the information that you say and then rewrite it in ways that are going to be hopefully mostly correct, but not entirely correct, and then share it with everyone? Why would you do that? Especially on very personal things. People share personal things all the time. And the answer is because there is just simply nothing better than finding someone who is interested in what you have to say. And this is my thesis, at least. Jeff, I want to hear what you have to say. But when you find someone who is genuinely interested in a thing that you have to say and say more about that is basically, I am interested in what you have to say such that I want you to go deeper into this thing that you just said. It's like that feeling, that message in the smallest number of words, that it instantly opens people up because that is what they want.
I totally agree. There's a phrase I learned from one of my mentors, Diana Smith, who said, the desire to know cultivates the willingness to tell. And so say more basically is an indication of our desire to know. And to your point, another category of professional listeners I interviewed for the book is journalists. And I interviewed one investigative journalist who literally did this entire investigative report that ultimately led several CEOs to lose their job for business malfeasance after she had interviewed them in this. And she said to me, like, why would they tell me all these things that ultimately they know I'm a reporter that I could use against them, which I did. She won major prizes for doing this. And she said, I think the reason is I just expressed interest in them and nobody in their life around them seemed to have cared about them that much to be asking them more questions. And they had some need to be listened to and to be heard. And so I met that need and it all came out. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a lot of what Say More does. The other magic question, just while we're on like things that work like magic as it relates to listening, is a strategy that I also talk about in the book called paraphrase and test, which is just simply saying to the other person, here's what I think I heard you say. Did I get that right? It's just that simple. It's just basically playing back to the other person. Sometimes people call it a tell back. And then checking, how well did I hear you? What did I miss? And I will tell you, at least 50% of the time when I do this, people will say, actually, that's not what I meant. Or, that's what I said, but actually, there's more to it than that I didn't tell you yet. And so I learned so much more. But it also has two other incredible benefits, one of which is it slows down the conversation. So if there's any kind of tension or argument or heatedness in the conversation, it just gives both people a chance to catch their breath. Instead of coming back with my next counterpoint, I'm just slowing us down by saying, did I understand you? But the other thing is, I think it also sends a message to the other person. I care enough about what you have to say and where you're coming from that I'm going to take up my time to try to actually put into words what I think you're saying and then ask you. And so it also has a relational benefit as well that I think it can work wonders.
Yeah. One other thing I'll say on the things that you shared, by the way, if anyone has any questions, throw them out, was the insight that people are often at the beginning sharing the things that are maybe least deep and that you have to let some of that stuff out. You what was your language for it? You had a term for it. I don't remember now. Pull the thread.
Yes.
Yeah. I have always thought of it in interviewing as let out the balloon, because when I sit down with someone, they have a preconceived idea of what it is that we're going to talk about and what it is that I'm going to be interested in. And I know that before I get to the things that I'm actually interested in, I am going to have to let them say all of those things to me. So I think of it as letting the air out of the balloon, because I just feel like it all has to come out. And then once it does, and they've deflated, now we can have an actual conversation. And so if I've done this for years and years interviewing celebrities, which is like a really time intensive process, because you don't get that much time with someone and you need them to say something that's going to be interesting and new and fresh, and you have to develop a rapport and you got to do it all in an hour and a half. It's really hard. And so I will usually let, even though this is one third of my time with them, if it's an hour and a half, I will let them just say the boring things that they've said to everybody to me for a half hour straight. I've heard it all before. None of it's going to go into the story, but I basically just want to show them that I'm hearing the things that they're usually saying. They are performing in the way that they think I want. And then once I hear all that, I can pick up some little thing that they had said and dig into it in a different way and show them that I was really listening and hearing and that I'm not asking them the things that everyone else asks. And that's usually the moment in which they start saying interesting things.
Wow. Love that. And I love that metaphor. I've not heard of that before, thought about it that way, but it makes a lot of sense. So I appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah. All right. So there's
one last.
There's one last. Hit us.
Yes. It's called Reflect and Reconnect. And this to me is, this is my favorite. I am a kind of learning nerd, learning junkie. And reflection is really where we squeeze the learning out of experiences. And I think a lot of people think about reflection as something mysterious, or I don't have time to reflect, or I have to go on some meditation retreat if I really want to reflect. But I talk about reflection as a very concrete and practical process. I call it sift it and turn it. So sift it is simply taking everything that we heard from someone, maybe just thinking back on the conversation, maybe looking at our notes, maybe listening to the recording if we want, whatever way we do it, and saying of all of that, what were the two or three most important, most interesting, most valuable nuggets that I heard from the person? That's just sift it. And also, by the way, let me sift out some things that I don't need to take in, because not every piece of feedback we get from people we need to take in, and not everything is meant for us as well. And so sifting it is basically letting go of the stuff we don't need and really keeping the gold, the good stuff. And sometimes to sift it well, we need to sift it with a friend or a partner or a coach or a therapist or anybody who can really help us get out of our own stuff in some ways so that we can make sure we're getting the gold. And then once we've sifted it, we go to turn it. And that just means turning it over in our minds three times. The first turn is what I call story level reflection, which is just to say, how does what I heard change my story about this person, about myself, about the situation, about what I'm trying to do here? The second level is what I call steps level reflection. And so once my, now given how my story has evolved, what steps can I take? Do I need to apologize? Do I need to make a decision? Do I need to double down? Do I need to get out of here? Do I need to take action? Whatever it is, the steps. And then the third is the deepest one that I think is often the hardest, but the most interesting, which is what I call stuff, reflecting on my stuff. So is there anything I heard here that might illuminate for me a bias that I have, or an assumption that I'm holding deeply, or a way of being, or some worldview, or something about my life experience? And that's where some of the richest learning can happen. And so it's story, steps, and stuff are the three reflective turns to really squeeze the insight out. And then I call this reflect and reconnect, because it's not just about taking the insight for ourselves. It's not, this is not like an extractive process where I'm just taking everything I can learn from you to make myself better. The reconnect is closing the loop, is going back to the other person and saying, thank you for what you shared. And thank you for the risk that you took and the time that you took to do it. And here's how I grew from it. And here's how it changed me. And here's what I'm going to do about it. And by the way, is there anything else you would have hoped that I would have taken from what you said? Or is there any way you would want to modify my takeaways from what you would have said? And I think that reconnecting, that closing the loop is very rare. People don't often get that coming back to them. And it does a few things. It lets them know they were valued. It shows them they didn't waste their time. It shows them how powerful they are because they actually affected you. And I think it also radically increases the chances they're going to want to share again because they know how much it means to you as well. So that's the last step, reflect and reconnect.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. How long would you say, as you teach this to people, it takes for people to get it? This is a lot to program into yourself, into what are both casual and then also structured conversations. And it may not come natural to people.
So a lot of what I have tried to bring together in the book comes from teachers, ideas, mentors that I've been very fortunate to have over the years. One of them is someone named Chris Argyris, who's no longer alive, but he was a professor both at Harvard Education School and Harvard Business School. He studied how can we help people in organizations do better at learning from each other, especially smart people who he said were some of the worst at learning. And so he developed a set of these ideas. And I had the chance to work with him, and I said to him, basically your exact question. I said, Chris, how long does it take to get good at this stuff, or halfway good at it? And he basically said, he looked at me and he said, about as long as it takes to learn how to play a mediocre game of tennis, which kind of means you're not going to get it in one sitting. You're not going to get it just by taking a quick training on it. But it also doesn't take a lifetime to get it. You could take 10 tennis lessons or 12 tennis lessons and get out there and be somewhat mediocre if you practice a little bit. And so there's a whole chapter in the book called Make It Your Superpower, which is all about how to actually learn this. And a lot of this is about breaking it down to certain pieces. You don't have to do it all at once. You might say, I'm just going to practice asking people to say more. And that's going to be the thing that I'm going to start with. Or I'm going to practice just centering in my mind this question of what can I learn from this person? And I encourage people to start in low stakes situations. So you don't have to be doing this on your highest stakes client meeting or investor meeting or most tense argument with your partner. But start in low stakes situations and let people know that you're trying something new. And then ask them how it went. And it's just basically learning anything, a process of practice, feedback, practice, feedback, practice, feedback, and then try the next thing. And you start to build it into your repertoire.
Yeah. Something else that I found really useful, I'll just share, is related to something you had described in terms of reflecting back the things that you had heard to people, even if what you're saying is not exactly a proper understanding of what they're saying, which is theories. I picked up this idea from, or this strategy from Ira Glass, who when I was in college, I went and I saw Ira Glass speak. Ira Glass from This American Life, it's a groundbreaking radio show. And he said that one of his favorite interview techniques, which I have stolen and use all the time now, and probably use some version of even in this conversation, is theories, which is that you take something that somebody said. You have to be in the conversation a little bit already. So you're gathering some information, you're making some connections. And then you say, Jeff, that's so interesting that you say that. I wonder if the reason why that works is actually because of, and then you like say some other piece of information that you might've gotten from that person or some insight that you have, and you put it to them. And even if you are incorrect, it doesn't matter, because the point of proposing a theory is not to be correct about the theory. The point of the theory is to encourage them to think on their feet and to process information in front of you. Now, usually I'm doing that for the purposes of an interview. So I'm trying to get somebody to get to an interesting insight. But in any kind of business or any kind of relationship building, you basically want to do the same thing too, right? You want to signal to people that you're listening deeply, but then you also want to encourage them to go through the process of thinking and processing with you, because that's what's fun. What's not fun is standing in front of someone and just reciting stuff over and over again. What's fun is finding someone who you can bounce ideas back and forth of, which means that if I'm posing a theory, I've spent some time processing something and now I'm going to share it with you and you're going to think in front of me and process it back. And now we're going somewhere together. And that I have found almost without fail gets people in different places than we might have started.
Yeah, I think you're modeling a version of that in this very moment as well. But I love that for multiple reasons. One is that I think that the ask approach does not require or even imply that all we do is ask questions. There's lots of room in it for us to say our own theories and for us to put out hypotheses and to get people to react to. But also I think what you're saying illustrates that when we're asking people questions, including asking them for what's your reaction to this theory that I just put out there, we're giving them a chance to develop their own thinking too. It's not, they may not know what they actually think until you've provoked or prompted them in some kind of way. And that's why I think to the point that in the chat from Ali, this is a mutual thing. This is not just for the benefit of us to extract from them. A good question gives somebody else the chance both to be self-expressed, but to sometimes to find out what they really think in the first place, because then they get to hear it come out of their own mouth.
Yeah. So Lisa, your comment there just prompted me to think of a meta question that I'm going to ask Jeff. So Lisa just wrote, love how you break this down, digest. So Jeff, a lot of people in this group are also communicators in some form or another. Every entrepreneur has to be. And you have done a great job of taking what can feel like an abstract concept, coming up with this very practical, organized system that can be taught and discussed. And I'm curious how you came to that, because you had to learn this process of asking and you had to understand it. But then it's another thing to start to develop the theory of it and the list of the five and the way in which to pair it. And I'm just curious, as someone who's in business and who is in many ways now the business of this, how you have created that structure of communication that you're now able to share this with.
Yeah, I appreciate that question. And it's a good chance for me to actually, I don't know that anyone's posed me that question before. So I'm going to think out loud.
Yeah, great.
And develop my own thinking in all of this. So I think it's a few things. In my career over the last 25 plus years, I've often toggled back and forth between business and education, those two sectors. And the amount of time that I've spent in education has taught me that people need things in chunks to learn them. There's literally like a learning science strategy called chunking, which is basically breaking big things up into small pieces so that people can digest those small pieces and hold them in their working memory long enough to be able to practice and process and start to move them into their, hold them in their working memory to move them into their long-term memory. And so some of that is just what I have been trained and learned to do over time, which is to make things learnable for people and break it down. Some of it is that I have spent years and years just teaching this stuff personally to groups, sometimes in formal training settings, and sometimes in one-on-one coaching of people that I work with. And so I've just gotten a lot of experience seeing how much can people take in and how do you package it in a way that connects and resonates with people. And then also some of it is that I mentioned Chris Argyris as one of the people who's, you know, deep body of intellectual work this draws upon. He founded a field called action science, and there's this very powerful thick book called Action Science. It also draws on work from people like David Cantor, who was the founder of the family systems theory. But a lot of, I found over and over that a lot of the way that they expressed that was too academic for most people to take in. And I could never recommend their books because no one would actually make it through the books. But I knew how powerful their ideas were. And so I was just incredibly motivated to figure out, how do we translate something that I know is so incredibly powerful into something that's learnable, and then try to bring my own sort of learning skills and knowledge that I've developed over time into that. And out came this on the other side.
It reminds me of a conversation that I had with a guy named Jonathan B. Smith, who is Chris Voss's business partner. If anybody knows Chris Voss, he's now famous within the world of famous negotiators.
Don't split the difference.
Yeah, for Never Split the Difference. And a former FBI hostage negotiator who wrote a best-selling book. And anyway, so Jonathan B. Smith is his business partner and is the guy who actually built like the business of Chris Voss, built the flywheel that is that kind of content to business flywheel. And we were talking about my own work and where there are missed opportunities. And what he basically said is, you have a lot of good ideas, but what you don't have is all those ideas organized into what could be a guidebook. Even the book that I wrote, frankly, is not necessarily a guidebook. It's not a step one, step two, step three, step four, step five. And if you can get your ideas to do that, so that there could be like a series of worksheets that people could do and a process that people could move through, then it sticks. It like sticks much more than if it's just a bunch of ideas. And I found that to be Julius's framework and organized systems of your thought process. Yeah, that was a real breakthrough moment for me. And I would say I'm still not fully there, but it is now the framework through which I see how to successfully share big ideas in ways that are going to relate to people the most.
Yeah, that deeply resonates. And you know, for whatever reason, I have always been motivated by making learning stick, especially if it's learning that I deeply believe in. And in a variety of different contexts, I've just tried to say, like, how do we make this thing sticky, learnable, digestible?
Yeah. Jeff, this has been awesome. What is your guidance for anyone who wants to get in touch with you or learn more about what you do?
I love to connect with people. You can easily find me on LinkedIn, Jeff Wetzler. Please just connect with me. I'd love to be in touch. You can also learn more about all these ideas on the website, www.askapproach.com. There is a little quiz to help you see which of the skills of the ask approach you're stronger in, which ones you might need to grow in, how good of an asker are you overall, but also lots of articles and resources and podcasts and different things that you can download. And then, of course, you can get the book anywhere you find books.
Yeah, awesome. And I'm gonna edit down this and release it as a podcast as well to help you get the word out more about your work. So, well, I'll give everyone about a few minutes back of their day and I'll find out what my 5-year-old wanted. Part of it was apparently to pull a pillow out of the couch that stuck. So we'll take care of that. And anything else, I'll just say for folks, I'll send the video of this out to the full group tomorrow. And then starting next Monday, I'm going to start doing those posts on LinkedIn. So thanks for everyone for chiming in on that. And sorry again to Sahara Rose for randomly asking you if you did a thing that you didn't do because I forgot, because I have 4 hours of sleep in me. And now I'm going to stop talking. Jeff, wonderful to see you.
Thank you so much. I love this conversation. It's great to meet you all.
And that's our episode. I would love to hear what you think and maybe even about a problem that you solved. You can find me at my website, jasonpfeiffer.com, JASONFEIFER.com. Also, I have some more useful stuff for you. I write a newsletter about how to future-proof yourself and become more adaptable and optimistic. I would love for you to sign up. It is at jasonpfeiffer.bulletin.com. Also, check out my other podcast. It's called Build for Tomorrow. In each episode, I take on some belief that we have that holds us back from progress and show you why it is not as bad as you think. Problem Solvers is a production of Entrepreneur Media and comes out every Monday morning, so make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss an episode. Thanks to Deepa Shah for production. My name is Jason Pfeiffer. See you next week.